Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Fortnight in Film. I'm your host Jason.
And I'm your co-host George.
Thanks for tuning in.
What was the best film that you've watched over the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, so a rewatch, another rewatch for me. I know 2 weeks ago I also picked a rewatch and Some Like It Hot. It's funny, I'm not a big rewatcher. You know, some people, you see them on Letterboxd all the time, they're just rewatching the same films constantly. But funnily enough, in the last week, of the 10 films I've watched, half of them have been rewatches. My point in saying all of that is I haven't watched this film probably for about 15 to 20 years, I would say. I would estimate probably I haven't watched it since childhood. And that film is The Wizard of Oz. I'll give a sneak peek to episode 5. We'll be discussing what we think the best year in film is. Now, 1939 isn't going to be my pick, but you could make the argument based on Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, both directed by Victor Fleming, both released in 1939.
I totally forgot that Wizard of Oz was directed by Victor Fleming.
Well, it's a weird directorial thing. He directed most of it, but there were like a couple of other directors early on, and then like King Vidor, he finished the film. So it had a few different people, but it's attributed to Victor Fleming because he did most of it.
I see, okay.
I wouldn't pick 1939 as the best year in film, but I think you could make the case because it's like it has two of the most iconic, popular, and enduring films ever.
So, A Wizard of Oz, what did you like about it?
Really, everything. I mean, generally, if I give a film 5 stars, I can't find any flaws of it. Or if I can, they're so minor that I'm just nitpicking.
I mean, it's a childhood staple for many people. Those flying monkeys scared the hell out of me when I was a child. Really, really did. But I just remember watching it when I was maybe 8 or 9. And just being blown away by the, you know, the whole tornado, when Dorothy first gets there, the witch used to scare me a lot as well. It's just all those factors really made it this huge thing in my head. And I watched it countless times.
I didn't know how highly it was rated. So on Rotten Tomatoes, it's 99% with a 9.5 average. Metacritic, it's 100 out of 100.
Wow.
IMDb, it's 8 out of 10. Letterboxd, it's 4 out of 5. So I gave it 5 stars. I don't know if that's a true reflection of how I feel about it, but I sort of caved to pressure and I was like, yeah, I'll give it 5 stars. Do I really think it's a 5-star film? Maybe, maybe not. It's probably more like 4.5 to me. But I think it's also a nostalgic factor as well, because I know, for instance, I rewatched Home Alone earlier this year. Again, a film I probably hadn't seen since childhood. And I gave that 5 stars. Is Home Alone a 5-star film? Debatable. But it was like a nostalgia factor. It's hard to sort of pin down what makes it so great because I feel like it's just this whole amalgamation of factors. So I spoke at the end of last week's podcast how filming in black and white can add something to the film. And I think it's similar with Technicolor. Just like in Gone with the Wind and countless other films, it adds something to it. Going from the sort of sepia-toned Kansas, which in itself has this sort of like romantic nostalgic quality, but going from that to the pop of color and brightness that is Munchkin Land, and then as they go through Oz, I feel like the colors help bring the story to life more than if it was in black and white, or more than if the whole movie was in sepia, for instance.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, Technicolor just brings such a sort of vibrancy.
It's richness, yeah, richness and vibrancy, yeah. You know, the dialogue and the script, it's interesting. Like, the only films I've seen pre-1950 would be The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and It's a Wonderful Life. But I love all those sort of 50s films, 60s as well, but especially 50s I love. People spoke differently then. And I mean, of course they spoke differently because it was 80 years ago, but, you know, I looked at the script of The Wizard of Oz and it was sort of a more, you know, refined way of speaking.
Well, you have the sort of transatlantic accent, so that the British-American amalgamation, which a lot of people view as very sort of, you know, classy of, you know, of that time. So it sort of harkens back to that era.
And even just, you know, you look at actors in that day and age, like they could do it all. You look at The Wizard of Oz, they have to act, they have to sing, they have to dance. I mean, nowadays, you're lucky if you can get people who can act. You know, let alone, you have to sing songs and you have to do dance numbers. And I think talking about the singing, like the songs are so catchy. Pretty much all the songs in there, they're all still well known. Like, you know, we're off to see The Wizard, Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead, Over the Rainbow.
Of course, they're so iconic. Yeah, and Judy Garland has a beautiful voice.
I was just about to say the same thing. Like, it's, I wish we'd heard more of her, because really the only time we get her on her own is in Over the Rainbow, which she sings wonderfully. I mean, I'd compare it to something like, and this is also one of the great musicals, I'd compare it to someone like Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, which is a similar film, again, in that the songs just get stuck in your head for days.
Yeah, once again, I absolutely love that. I used to watch it so much as a child. I once went on holiday to sort of the German Alps area, and I watched it there, and I went to Salzburg the next day as well, and it just made it such a better experience. So I was like looking, oh look, they filmed that there.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I too have been to Salzburg, where they filmed a lot of it, so I can very much relate. You look at an actress like Judy Garland, I believe she was 17 when she played the part.
Yes, she has some issues, actually. There's a bit of a dark undertone to The Wizard of Oz, which I haven't researched extensively, but apparently there were instances of sort of abuse directed towards her. I need to research a bit more, but apparently she didn't have the best of times on set.
Well, one of the things that I read, that she, you know, throughout her whole career, she was regarded by, you know, these movie executives as someone who was ugly. And you look at her and she's, I mean, I wouldn't consider her ugly at all.
No, I just don't think she fit the mold of what they wanted in terms of sort of the classic Hollywood beauty. She was an extremely good looking person, but I don't think, yeah, she sort of fit the mold of what they wanted, and she sort of got a bit of stick for that.
Well, I mean, you look at a lot of the actresses in the classic Hollywood era, even the actors, even the males, they all have a similar sort of look. You know, if you look at them all the males somewhat look the same, the females somewhat look the same. Obviously, you know, they were going for a specific look, so they went and cast people who looked a certain way. But it is interesting that, you know, even someone like Judy Garland, who in ways sort of fits that mold, you can see a sort of similarity there. But even if she doesn't, like you said, she was not, you know, unattractive in the slightest. But even she was, you know, criticized and vilified because she didn't look a certain way.
For sure, for sure.
Like we were saying before, just the enduring legacy of the film, that it's still so popular so many years later and it's still so well known. And even like things like quotes, you know, people will still use quotes in certain situations, like, oh, we're not in Kansas anymore, or, you know, follow the yellow brick road, or talking about, you know, the man behind the curtain. It sort of imbued itself into popular culture, unlike many other films, I would say.
Yeah, spot on. I totally agree. Yeah, it's one of those classics that, you know, if you mention Gone with the Wind, some youngsters now may not sort of recognize it. But if you say, oh, The Wizard of Oz, most people will go, ah, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it sort of cuts across generations. Whereas I feel like film lovers would definitely know Gone with the Wind. The average person might have heard of it, but they wouldn't really know it. Whereas I feel like everybody knows The Wizard of Oz. It's just timeless. My only point of contention with the film, and this isn't really my point so much as it is, I feel like I missed the point. Right, so I'm more than happy to have it explained to me, because I feel like I just didn't get it, which is on me and not the film, because actually the film that I'm going to highlight for my worst pick of the last 2 weeks, I feel like had no meaning whatsoever, whereas The Wizard of Oz, I feel like very much had meaning, but I just didn't get it. I was looking up a lot of, you know, interpretations of what it meant after I watched the film, and for those who don't know, The Wizard of Oz was a book originally, when it was adapted for film. So, you know, a lot of the interpretations I read said that, you know, there was a very deep political interpretation to it. I read other things that said it's a religious allegory. I read things that said, oh, it's an atheist allegory. But the consensus generally was a few themes. I'll paraphrase some explanations that I found online, and then I'll make my point as to why I didn't get it. So the common themes were sort of around, you know, the idea that you already have what you need to succeed. The Scarecrow wanted brains, the Tin Man wanted a heart, and the Lion wanted courage. They get to the end of the film and they realize, oh, I've had these things all along. Then you get to Dorothy, and I'm like, well, what was Dorothy's quest? You know, what was her thing she was seeking? I read online, you know, people saying things like Dorothy wanted to be appreciated, that she thought things were better somewhere else, that she should be, you know, happy for what she had. It doesn't particularly follow, because the three sort of characters of Tin Man, Scarecrow and Lion, as sort of facets of her, in that, you know, she needs courage and heart and a brain and this sort of thing. But what does she need it for? I mean, obviously she needs it for life, yes. But the only real challenge she's facing in the real world, so far as I could tell, was Almira Gold, who was obviously the real world counterpart of the Wicked Witch of the West, taking away Toto. That's really the only sort of dilemma. And then I was reading other things saying that, you know, like, she realized that, you know, she had it good at the farm and that she shouldn't, you know, things were great where they were. But it's like, I did never think that whole running away thing was serious. If I remember correctly, she just had a little basket, if that, with her and Toto. I mean, that's hardly enough to, if you're going to seriously run away, you're not going to, you can take a bit more than that. So I didn't, you know, so it wasn't like she was going off into the world and thus she needed these traits or something. It that was my only contention, is I didn't, it obviously had these very epic themes of finding yourself and finding that you had all the things you needed all along, but I didn't find a real world counterpart as to why she needed these things and why she had to go on this epic quest and what the sort of moral of it was. But again, I feel like that's more me missing the message. So if someone out there wants to explain to me what it is about, I'm more than open to hear.
maybe I'll give it a rewatch. I'll give it a rewatch and attempt to, you know, offer my explanation.
What about you? What was your best film of the past 2 weeks?
I am returning to Hitchcock for my best film, like Psycho last week, with Rebecca from 1940, starring Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. I pretty much thought this was a perfect film. And I don't say that lightly, because I know there's realistically no such thing as a perfect film, right? As I was watching it, I was just kind of in awe at how well-crafted it was, you know? It was such, like, a haunting, masterpiece. I just loved it. I'm not going to spoil the plot. I'll give a little synopsis, but it deserves to be properly seen without some bloke on a podcast explaining it, because I won't do it justice.
It's adapted by a book from Daphne du Maurier, I believe.
It is. I'm going to raise that point because, sort of, obviously it's her novel, so she does the plot, and it's sort of that gothic feel, but Hitchcock really doubles down on that gothic aspect and atmosphere, really brings it out. Yeah, so I'll go into the premise quickly. So a young woman is in Monte Carlo, played by Joan Fontaine, working as a lady's companion, and she meets a very wealthy and recently widowed person called Maxime de Winter, played by Laurence Olivier. They fall in love. He sort of whisks her away from Monte Carlo back to his estate in Cornwall, this sort of massive, massive mansion called Mandalay. But the new Mrs. She's never named, but the new Mrs. de Winter finds it increasingly hard to fit in, because his ex-wife who is dead seems to sort of permeate through the house, through the staff. She, you know, the new Mrs. de Winter can't quite shake the feeling that she's constantly being compared to Rebecca, you know, that she's sort of an intruder into the house. And that's the sort of setup. The main driving force behind this feeling is the main housemaid, Mrs. Danvers, who has seemingly a sort of weird obsession with Rebecca. And she's sort of constantly reminding the new Mrs. Danvers of what Rebecca used to do. you know, how much everyone loved her.
And this was, we know I haven't seen any Hitchcock, but I believe this would have been the first Hitchcock adaptation of a Daphne du Maurier novel, because I believe The Birds was also written by her.
I think you're right, yes. I think you're right. I mean, he adapted a lot of novels.
Yes, yeah.
But this was actually his first Hollywood movie. He had come over from Britain. He'd been successful in England. He was working for a popular producer called David Selznick, who did a lot of the main Hollywood stuff. He wasn't quite at full, you know, creative control, but he was definitely, you could see his sort of development, you know, leaning into more of his classics later down the line. Sort of the whole aspects of the new Mrs. De Winter wanting to sort of measure up to Rebecca, it's just done so subtly and beautifully. Like, there are just hints throughout the whole thing of what Rebecca used to do, and you can see Mrs. De Winter figuring it out, thinking, oh, I need to do this, I need to look more beautiful, I need to do this to sort of please Max. And it goes even more deeper. Like, there are more twists and turns.
Would you say this is now your favourite Hitchcock film?
It is. It is. It's just, I love Psycho and Vertigo, but this sort of psychological drama just really got me. And it was the whole thing with, like, the presence of Rebecca. She's almost like a character, even though you never see her. Her presence is always felt in the film through every dialogue, every scene. It always comes back to sort of her. I won't spoil the ending, but sort of the point of the film is sort of vanquishing her memory so Maxim and the new Mrs. De Winter can sort of lead their life.
I don't think I've ever seen any films of his, but have you seen Laurence Olivier in any other roles?
I haven't actually, no. I know of his role in Henry V. I've seen clips of him there. But he was more a stage actor, I believe. So I haven't seen much film work, but he was great here. He was great. The best performance for me was Judith Anderson as Mrs. Danvers, who's the housemaid. You can see her sort of yearning for Rebecca. She obviously has an obsession with her. You can see it becomes more apparent, and there are definitely some sexual undertones there. It's sort of unclear as to whether it's more a maternal instinct that she sort of misses her, she sort of felt a maternal love, or if it's romantic. But the more the film goes on, you can tell she was definitely sort of romantically interested. Like, she's showing the new Mrs. De Winter her underwear and her clothes, and you can tell by her facial expressions, like, she does a really look like longing for Rebecca. There are shades of, well, you haven't seen Vertigo, have you? Vertigo.
I've not.
Okay, but Vertigo, it shares sort of themes with that, because that's about a man sort of attempting to remake someone he loved in, you know, through someone else. And this is the same thing. Like, at one point, Mrs. Danvers, she dresses Mrs. De Winter in one of Rebecca's old sort of clothes. And you can see she's sort of analysing her, sort of comparing her to Rebecca. She's saying, you're not good enough to be Rebecca. It's sort of that psychological aspect which I loved. Sort of the new Mrs. Winter has to become her own woman. She starts off as this sort of little mouse character, and she has to sort of grow out of her shell and get rid of Rebecca, so to speak. Sort of grow into her own woman, which Joan Fontaine does absolutely brilliantly.
Interesting. And I think you could even somewhat, again, not having seen both films, but from just hearing you talk about Psycho 2 weeks ago, I feel like you could draw comparisons between Rebecca and Psycho in that both stories feature, without ever really featuring the character, they revolve around this character, or this person, I should say, who's sort of lingering there, right? So in Rebecca's case, it would be Rebecca. In Psycho, it would be Mother Bates. Sort of the crux of the story is to do with both of these unseen characters, and they're sort of the main drivers, even though they're never actually on screen.
You're totally right. And there's actually a scene where Laurence Olivier, so Maxim, he's describing the movements of Rebecca. Like, there's this one scene where he's sort of talking about something that Rebecca did, and the camera sort of pans and follows what she would have been doing, like where she was in the room. And it's just brilliant because you're almost, even though you can't see her, you're picturing her there as you think she was, as the camera pans. It's, you know, Hitchcock just creates her as a character, even though she's not in the film. It's the notion of the unseen. You know, you're sort of scared of, or sort of nervous about what you can't see. That's why Rebecca has such an influence on the plot. And also the cinematography is some of the best of any Hitchcock film. Like the lighting, the camera, the way he captures sort of the rooms inside Mandalay. They kind of, when Mrs. De Winter arrives, she's kind of dwarfed by these huge rooms. So it makes you really feel she's not a part of this world. Like, she's not a lady. She's just a companion for an older person. She's suddenly in this new world and she's, you know, overwhelmed. Yeah, it's amazing how Hitchcock uses the camera to sort of show that and the set. Just to sum up, you know, it just captures such a sort of dreamlike and mysterious quality that I haven't seen many films replicate. Like, so, some moments it seems like a dream for new Mrs. De Winter, then it's a nightmare. It's all just rolled into one. And it's just a testament to how good films can be.
And can I just say in my defense, I have seen well over 500 films. I know that any time you or Christian talk about a film, it's like I haven't seen it.
But yeah. Maybe you're lying. Yeah, you're just getting your plots off like Wikipedia.
But I just read the Letterboxd synopsis and that's it.
Yeah. In all seriousness though, you must watch Hitchcock. You must. He's just a classic director. And one last thing, Joan Fontaine is just, I couldn't help comparing her to her sister, Olivia de Havilland. Their sisters, they had a big rivalry in their career. They sort of hated each other, sort of competed for Academy Awards and whatnot. She's brilliant as well, but I just couldn't help in my mind thinking, you know, sort of comparing their performances. But maybe I can do a segment on that in the future.
Yes, well, I was thinking if we did another great female rivalry of classic Hollywood to talk about would be Joan Crawford and Betty Davis.
Yes.
Who I actually have. I haven't watched it yet, but I have it. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Yeah, isn't that starring both of them, isn't it?
Correct. So there was a story. I mean, it wasn't a story. It was true that Betty Davis was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actress. And Joan Crawford, as anybody who has read or seen Mummy Dearest, was perhaps not the nicest person. And she was apparently jealous that Betty Davis had been nominated and that she hadn't. And so what Joan Crawford did was she contacted everyone else who was nominated for Best Actress and said, if you can't go to the Academy Awards, I will accept the award on your behalf. And Betty Davis also said that Joan Crawford went and like lobbied against her to the Academy so that she wouldn't win. And ultimately, Anne Bancroft won for The Miracle Worker, which I think would probably go down. Not that I've seen that movie, but I've heard that Betty Davis's performance was that good that basically Anne Bancroft winning was one of the biggest snubs in Academy Award history. And I remember watching an interview with Betty Davis, actually, where she mentioned that Joan Crawford, you know, her strategy of doing that was really quite stupid, because if Betty Davis had won, that would have made them all so much more money, because, you know, it would have been that much popular. But Joan Crawford was so jealous,
allowed her personal feelings to get in the way. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Which is a shame. And also, I believe, and quote me on this, but I believe that if Betty Davis had won that Academy Award, she would have been something like the most Academy Awards in a career for a female at that time or something. Because she already had about 3 or 4, I think. So
Katharine Hepburn has 4, so she is a leader right now. I don't know what Betty Davis would have been on.
Yeah, so she won 2. And she was out of 10 nominations. But I think if she'd won that one, I think she might have, you know, been the first to get to 4 years or something. It was something where if she'd won the Academy Award for whatever happened to Baby Jane, it would have been a historic thing. And it was obviously prevented by Joan Crawford's jealousy, which is upsetting. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, linking to that, just a little information nugget. Joan Fontaine got her first Oscar nomination for Rebecca, but then she won a year later for another Hitchcock film, Suspicion, and that was the only time an actor or an actress won an Oscar for a Hitchcock role. So, shall we move on to worst films?
So, mine is another rewatch, funnily enough. So, I have seen this, I probably hadn't seen The Wizard of Oz for about 15 to 20 years. I have seen this film somewhat recently. I couldn't tell you how long ago, but somewhat recently. So originally I had it at a 3.5 stars. Upon rewatching, I downgraded it to half a star.
Half a star.
Which is the lowest rating Letterboxd allows you to give. I still feel like I was perhaps a bit too harsh, but I will attempt to justify it to myself in the next few minutes. So the film is Forrest Gump. Like, there's not one redeeming factor about it for me.
That really, really surprises me. Not even one.
Like, what's the point of a film?
What about Tom Hanks? What about Tom Hanks' performance? Was that not great?
It's just dumb. It's just, his performance, and I love Tom Hanks, but his performance is dumb. The character's dumb. The story's dumb. What's the point of it? What is the point of Forrest Gump?
I can't quite remember. I'm just reading the plot synopsis. So what happens at the end? He's reunited with Jenny. That's it. They move back to Greenbow and she dies. I can't remember exactly the story, but isn't his sort of character growth there? Like, doesn't he grow as a character? Like, he finally gets a family, has a son.
Well, I mean, I didn't really view it as his character growth, because the whole film is centered around everything that happens to him is just seemingly by chance, you know, like none of it is really him. The film is just like he bumbles through life and all these things happen to him, and it's like he really has no agency or directive to do anything. It's more like things happen to him.
Doesn't he meet the president at one point?
Oh, I think he meets both presidents. I believe he meets Lyndon B. Johnson. Well, actually, we would have met JFK first because he was before LBJ. I believe he meets JFK and then he meets LBJ. But, like, there's no point to it. There's no point to the story. Like, it doesn't matter what way you look at it. It doesn't work. You look at it as a story of one man's life. Well, again, that's ridiculous, because one thing in the film would be amazing if it happened to him. Oh, but here's all these things happened to him. Oh, Elvis Presley just happened to board in his house. Oh, and then he meets John Lennon on Johnny Carson or whatever it is. And oh, John Lennon just happens to take his quotes and use them to write Imagine. Oh, and he becomes the ping pong champion of the world. Oh, and he's this star running back at Alabama. And he's all this different stuff. And like all these ridiculous things happen to him. He exposes the Watergate scandal, and he's at this, big anti-war rally, and he's at the historic thing of where, African-American students can finally go to college, and he's at all these different events in life. Like, none of that would happen to one person. We're expected to believe these 50 fantastical things all happen to this one person.
I totally understand you. I'm going to have to rewatch it again to see if there's to see if I grasp maybe a different meaning as to why these events are happening.
Well, that's sort of my point, is there's no reason. There's no point they're happening. They're just happening.
All I remember is, run, Forrest, run, that bit. That used to stick in my mind a lot.
I will say also, like, I hate films that are narrated. It's so annoying. It's one of my biggest pet peeves in film. If I'm watching a film, because I have a rule, right? My rule is if a film doesn't hook me in the first 10 minutes, I turn it off.
You won't even give it a chance up until maybe the halfway point?
No. My time is valuable. I don't have a time to waste on that. I'm a busy man.
Fair play.
For me, if I'm watching a film that has narration, that's almost an instant turn off for me. Because I hate it so much. Like, didn't these screenwriters, producers, directors, whoever, didn't they learn it's about show, not tell? Like, why do you have to have your film narrated? Can't you show that through the action? Why do you have someone... And Forrest Gump, the whole thing is narrated. The whole way through, isn't it? Because the whole point of it is he's sitting on this bench waiting for the bus. And he tells his life story to all these people who happen to come and sit on the bench next to him. But it's like, if the whole film is narrated, it's like, why can't you just show it? Why do you have to have someone telling us the whole way through what happens? Like, do you think we're stupid? Do you think the audience is dumb? We're not going to get it. I mean, I get that the setup of the story of having him sitting on this bench telling his life story gives itself to the story being narrated, but it's just a big pet peeve of mine. I do not like narration in films whatsoever. It's very annoying. There's very little I can find redeeming about this film. I used to like it. I had it at a 3.5, which in my rating system is good. I had it as a good film. And, you know, I'll give it a small point of compliment in that it obviously does keep your attention because all this crazy stuff is happening to him and you're like, you know, what's going to happen next? But it's all so incredibly far-fetched. I just couldn't take any of it seriously. I don't get the message the film was trying to say. I said, I don't even think it was a message personally. If there is, I completely missed it. To me, it was, and this is a big call, but it was probably just one of the stupidest films I've watched. I can't say much more than that. What about you? What was your worst film?
So I'm going to get absolutely, you know, destroyed by two of my friends.
No, I mean, don't worry. See, I took all the heat for you by picking Forrest Gump. So anything you pick, you can't get as much heat as I'm going to get.
Well, that's true. These guys are sort of, you know, really big Bond fans. So I might get a bit, you know, but it's You Only Live Twice, the fifth Sean Connery film coming after Thunderball in 1967. The reason I watched it, I've been watching the Bond films in preparation for No Time to Die, and I've never watched each of them in full. And you know, I've got to embrace my Britishness and, you know, embrace Bond. And on the whole, I've been enjoying them up until this one. From Russia with Love and Goldfinger are two Connery classics, which I liked a lot. Thunderball was okay, then it's a bit of a downward slope. But yeah, I was just disappointed with this one in quite a lot of aspects. It follows Bond and the Japanese Secret Service finding and stopping the true culprit of a series of space hijackings before war is provoked between Russia and the US. So it's quite obviously it's Spectre behind the scenes. The plot setup was good. There was a good classic Bond start. Bond then arrives in Japan, in Tokyo, amid all, you know, the neon lights and stuff. I really enjoyed it. But then it just lost focus for me after that. It follows him doing typical Bond things like stealing plans, fighting bad guys, you know, trying to get to the true nature of the, you know, scheme. But it just felt so much less engaging than previous Sean Connery films. It just didn't feel quite right. There was no spark for me. Good action scenes. There's a great helicopter fight around an hour in, which I loved. You have the reveal of Blofeld, you know, the iconic villain with the ring, you know, with the cat. Great. There was a great reveal of him at the end, along with the final fight scene, which is good. But yeah, it just felt, a lot of it just dragged. It just felt dull. I'm being quite harsh on it here. I did like some aspects. I certainly did. But it just went off the rails for me.
I mean, I haven't seen any Bond films, surprise, surprise. But I think, didn't Sean Connery do one last Bond film after this?
He returned. They switched to George Lazenby,
a fellow Australian,
for the next one on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Yeah, then he came back for one in 1971. But even by this one in 1967, this was another one of my major gripes. You could tell he just could not give a flying hoot about being in this. Like, you could tell his heart was just not in it. He was on it so much in Goldfinger, which I liked. He was just classic charisma, strolling around. Even Thunderball, he was still on it. But this one, the sense of joy, like the sense of adventure from him, I just couldn't sense it. And he just looked different. Like, obviously, aging exists. That's fine.
How dare you get old?
How dare you age? But he just looked kind of yeah, he just looked different to sort of the classy, good-looking Bond of the previous ones. That, and also, it's this one was getting a lot more to like the goofy Bond adventures that become the staple. And there's nothing wrong with it. I like a goofy film sometimes, but when the film is actually good, I enjoy it. Like the ones before were sort of, yeah, like very good spy plots, quite serious. And this one just took a goofy turn that I didn't feel merited being in it. But overall, yeah, there were some fun parts. I liked about 30% of it. There is a part where the Japanese Secret Service try to make Bond look Japanese. They have some, they put, and all that consists of is a haircut and some eye makeup. And, you know, from that point on, it just went downhill. So, yeah. So sorry, Sam and Tom, if you're listening. I know you're going to roast me in our group chat. I gave it 2 out of 5 on Letterboxd. I thought that was a fair reflection of my thoughts.
So, I know that you wanted to talk more for back of episode 1 about Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton.
I did. Last week was my extended, you know, love letter to Charlie Chaplin. But this week, I wanted to talk about Buster Keaton, who is another star of the silent era. I got into his work kind of randomly. I saw a box set of his short films and I just got it and started to work my way through. The box set was interesting because he was similar to Chaplin in that he was a child performer, became a stage actor, so like a vaudeville comedy performer. Then he got his break in Hollywood working with a comedian called Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. So he owned a movie studio, made short comedy films, and he sort of invited Keaton to come in and do one. And it sort of went on from there, and Keaton's influence grew as the years went on. And I'm not really a fan of Arbuckle's comedy. It mostly involves him dressing up as a woman and chasing after some girls, or just doing really, I don't know, it's not my type of comedy. But it starts to get boring when it's every single skit. And you can see Buster Keaton, he's sort of tiny appearance in the first one. Then as it goes on, he sort of grows in stature. And you can see him kind of figuring out how to hone his comedy style. Then by the middle of the box set, Arbuckle leaves. He left in about 1920. He was going through, I think, quite a serious rape case against him. So he had to leave. Keaton becomes the star of the show. And from then on, he's sort of in his prime, I'd say, from 1920. Then he took over the company and started to make feature films. The most famous one being The General. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of it. I haven't seen it, obviously, but I've heard of it.
It's probably his most famous silent film. It's a Civil War film about the hijacking of a train. And he's sort of chasing this. It's like a locomotive chase. He's like the sort of driver of this train. If you want to see a Keaton film, you should watch that. It has everything that makes him great. Like just crazy stunts that any man would be just mental to even consider. His sort of deadpan expression that got him the nickname the Great Stone Face, just sort of totally deadpan. Oh, different to Chaplin, which I'll get into. The obvious difference straight out of the gate is that Keaton is much more physical than Chaplin. You know, he has this stone face, but he uses really expression, you know, his body language, and he does these crazy stunts that Chaplin just didn't really do. Chaplin tended to use his face much more and sort of subtle situations in his films instead of madcap physical stunts that would kill an ordinary person. And Chaplin also performed comedy set in daily life situations, so his films had more of a storyline. It was more sort of realistic comedy, and he felt more of a need to speak to the human heart and highlight social issues, like in The Great Dictator, at City Lights, whereas Keaton struck a more cynical and stoic tone. It was probably more modern than Chaplin in that sense. Like, I think Keaton's comedy tends to work better for modern audiences, I think. It's sort of similar to today more. His films weren't very sentimental. They often involved something simple like chasing a train, like a town being destroyed. And he would throw in romance as more of a subplot, but there was nothing too sentimental, whereas Chaplin would make the sentimentality, the centerpiece of the film. He made his tramp character often pitied and encouraged the viewer to be sympathetic towards him, like in City Lights. For me, one of the best acting performances ever.
You better watch out. Christian will have something to say about that. And Cillian Murphy and Disco Pigs, you better...
We're going to have a fist fight about that. I like Keaton a lot, but nothing comes close for me in terms of awakening emotions in the audience when it comes to Chaplin. But Keaton is more the comedy. It's purely for laughs. It's like stunts, purely for laughs. Chaplin did those laughs, but he also combined it with sentimentality, if that makes sense. So that's and one more thing before
I quiz you,
before you quiz me. Chaplin continued his films into the talkie era, whereas Keaton went on a big downward spiral in 1929 because he signed a contract with MGM, lost creative control of pretty much everything. They forced him to do stuff, made him do talkies, and he couldn't adapt. And that's it. But Chaplin actually wrote a part for Keaton in his 1952 film Limelight. So Chaplin plays a struggling sort of aging comedian. I won't go into the film now because it's quite a long film. But there's a scene at the end where the Chaplin and Keaton do a scene together. And I just thought it was wonderful seeing these two sort of stars of the silent era doing this scene together when they were rivals. And they're now aging comedians. People have practically forgotten them for the most. Not Chaplin, Keaton maybe. More so. You know, these two powerhouses doing a scene together. I thought it was lovely.
Well, that's actually a great lead-in to my first question, which was the rivalry between them real, or was it sort of manufactured by the media?
That's a good question. I think it was manufactured a bit more. I think they liked each other, I read. They had a good relationship. It was more of a professional rivalry. I read a story, Chaplin's son, I think, had a friend over, and the son's friend stated his favourite silent comedian was Buster Keaton.
That's a bold move when you're at a kid's house, his dad is Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, I know. But apparently his son said this in the documentary, Charlie Chaplin was very upset. Like, he was not happy at all that Buster Keaton was favoured by this child. So that, to me, shows he valued his superiority in some sense over Keaton. And Keaton, I guess, I don't know the details, obviously, as, 100 or so years ago, but I imagine Keaton wanted to get, the up on Chaplin. But I guess in the end, symbolically, Chaplin won. I suppose he's much more famous. He's known all... I hadn't heard of Buster Keaton, but everyone has... You can see murals of Chaplin in, countries all around the world.
Who do you think was the better actor out of the two? And I know that's somewhat hard to assess because they're not talking, so it's hard for a modern audience to look at it and determine, because it's obviously... Well, obviously, you said Chaplin went into the talkies, but Keaton didn't. So if you're assessing both of their silent film periods, it's somewhat hard for a modern audience because we don't really have silent films anymore.
That's true. Assessing just their silent periods, I'd say Chaplin was the better actor. Keaton had a great ability to do this stone face and make the audience laugh because he would keep this dull face and things would just happen to him that were, crazy, like he'd jump on a tree and it would fly away, or a house would fall on him or something, and it's funny because he doesn't care, he's just like, oh, like this is happening. But Chaplin, I don't know, he just, the way he uses his facial expressions, his body language, his emotional scenes are much more sort of impactful in my opinion than Keaton's. I mean, it's difficult to compare because Keaton didn't focus on making the audience feel emotions as much as Chaplin. So Chaplin has more of an advantage in the sense that he used his acting ability to do that. So, but they were both masters of their own style. They were both geniuses. So I find it difficult to compare. Me personally, I prefer Chaplin's acting style, but it's all down to the viewer.
Yeah, and so on that point, and final question, given both of these actors are obviously titans of their time. Do you think that modern audiences need to reconnect with them in a sense? Because most film lovers, whether sort of, you know, they're quite into film like you and I and Christian are, or whether they're just sort of casual film watchers, I'd imagine most people probably haven't seen a lot of Chaplin or Keaton films. So do you think that there's a need to reconnect with that era of film?
I do. I think comedy now is getting a bit samey and stale. And I'm speaking a bit biased because I prefer that comedy. But I just think it's still, especially Keaton's comedy, it's quite modern. And I think if people gave it a chance, they would enjoy it. There are some rough patches, but on the whole, I think it translates quite well. People still love slapstick comedy, right? So I think both Chaplin and Keaton would translate well to modern. I mean, people still love Chaplin now, right? Like, he's still a star. But I think audiences, on the whole, do need to reconnect more with them, because they're, as you said, they're such titans. And I think, you know, if I have kids one day, I'm definitely showing them Chaplin and Keaton, and hopefully they'll be into them.
Well, that wraps up episode 3. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating on Apple Podcasts. I'll be back next week with Christian. George will be back in 2 weeks, also with Christian, when the three of us jump on a podcast together, and we'll chat soon.
All right. See you guys. Bye.
See ya.